Hello, and welcome to Once Upon a Time Walk. So, for those of you who are just now discovering us, we are a Magic the Gathering lore-based podcast. So, both David and I, my name's Adam, my co-host is Dave. One of the things that we noticed in the Magic the Gathering community was that there was no reliable, exhaustive, I guess you could say, source for magic lore in the sense of discussing it in a way that was not just retelling the story. I think Wizards does, even now, does a great job of telling the story, but they still have to tell a story. So for a lot of people, it's difficult to have reliable information on characters and settings and events that happen in the magic lore when the parent company, when Wizards, is attempting to keep some of this information secret for definitely valid story reasons. So what we're going to do here is we're just going to talk about the Magic the Gathering story, talk about some of the things that are going on in the story right now, give you a little bit of background. And hopefully we can continue doing this for a while, as long as the Magic the Gathering story keeps going. So
yeah, I sure hope so.
Yeah. So I think, Dave, you said you wanted to talk about, right off the bat, give some background, talk about some of the basics of Magic.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
Yeah, let's do that. So first of all, I'll also say hello, introduce myself. As Adam said, I'm Dave, sometimes known as Flavorical on the Tumblrs, and as Adam said, you know, it we wanted to have not only someplace that was reliable to talk about lore and Vorthos and flavor, but you know, there's a lot of podcasts and a lot of YouTube channels and everything that talk a lot about the mechanics of the game, how to build a good deck, what kind of decks are coming up, and there's a lot of great discussion and speculation when it comes to the mechanics. And that's great, but for those of us who love the lore, hey, wouldn't it be great if there was a podcast that got into not only defining that and recapping that, but also talking about it and
exactly,
getting a little bit crazy with theories and things. Adam, I thought it was funny how you said, for those of you that are just now discovering us, since this is our first episode, if you've already discovered us, I then got you. We know you are a time traveler, and so...
Well,
you fell right into our trap.
We did.
You've been found out.
We shot the idea. I know we shot the idea around on Tumblr. So some people,
well,
this
is
coming in advance. But I'm sure for many of you, hopefully there are many of you listening, this is probably the first you've heard of this.
Yeah, I still suspect they're time travelers, but that's just me. So yeah. So before we start talking about the lore and, you know, kind of get into the details of what's been going on, it helps to have some background. What is a planeswalker? What is a plane? What is the multiverse? Because these are words that we're going to be saying a lot. So if you've been just now getting into Magic, or even if you've been playing for a long time and you're just now kind of getting into the story because it's suddenly become a lot more accessible online than it was for years and years in the past. So, for those of you just now embracing your Vorthos side, let's get on the same page. Let's talk about some common terms. The first of those being Planeswalker. So, a Planeswalker is a powerful mage, a powerful magic user who is able to travel across planes. So, what is a plane? Well, a plane is a plane of existence. From a science fiction point of view, you could think of it as like different planets that you might go to, except it's really more than that, because each one is like its own separate reality. And, you know, hey, maybe the laws of magic are slightly different on one plane than another. You know, on one plane, maybe you know, the belief in something can actually cause an enchantment to come to life and,
ooh,
become a deity, like on Theros. Whereas other planes, you know, like Mirrodin, it's artificial. You've got people with metal artifacts, you know, growing out of the ground. So the planes are this multitude of realities, and for most people, they only know about the plane that they live in. You know, for us here on Earth, we might know about different planets, but if there's other dimensions, other realities out there, we don't know about them. That's the stuff of, you know, of theory. Well, the planeswalkers actually can go from one plane to another, and they can connect with the mana there, which, you know, helps them become even more powerful. Because, hey, if I'm somebody that draws upon green mana that I get from forests, well, hey, if I'm able to connect with forests of 15 different worlds, that's going to make me a lot more powerful than if I was just connecting on the forests of one world. Okay, so when you take a look at all of the planes as a whole, they make up the multiverse. So the multiverse is just that. It's all of the planes that are out there. So it's kind of a big, broad term, and the planeswalkers travel through the multiverse. And they travel through this space known as the Blind Eternities, which I often conceptualize as being like space, but it's not quite like space. It's funny things happen in the Blind Eternities. It's not really reality. It's not just a vacuum like, you know, like we think of space, but it's almost defined by what it's not. It is not reality. It is not, you know, where things and people live, with maybe some exceptions. And that brings up the last point that I want to bring in, and that is the Eldrazi. So the Eldrazi are the most recent kind of big, bad, antagonist, fearful force of the multiverse. And they are these beings that actually live in the Blind Eternities, and they devour planes. They eat entire, you know, worlds of existence. And because they live in the Blind Eternities, nobody, not even planeswalkers, can really understand or conceptualize what they are. They can only see kind of the features that poke through into reality when the Eldrazi start messing with things. So, because the current block, by the way, a block is talking about some sets of magic that are kind of grouped together to make a whole. So the current story block is all about Zendikar and the Eldrazi, and Adam is going to tell us all about where we are and what we're doing with those things. But Adam, let me know if you think I missed anything, or if there are any essential tidbits that I may have left out there.
Well, one of the things actually that I was interested in talking about, I have read a couple of the older Magic Gathering novels. They are all post-mending. I've read Teeth of Akum, and I've read that's about original Zendikar, and I've read Agents of Artifice. As far as established canon goes now, they're a little bit shaky. Magic had this weird thing with the novels where they were all independent writers created them, and they were just given sort of basic guidelines for what the story of Magic was, but each one kind of described things, similar things, very differently. So sure. Magic has now, I think, consolidated their official lore, their official story, and so they're working on getting that all reliable across the board.
They're cleaning some things up. They're making getting some things to be consistent, and I know that there's a lot of worry out there among, you know, people who have been very faithfully following the story for a long time about retconning or retroactively changing aspects of the story. You know, from my point of view, that's just kind of a necessary thing to do. Like you said, it was being written by a lot of different writers, and creative, while it was a part of the process, it was much less integrated with the design process than it is right now. And so, even if it leads to, you know, some minor retconning, some minor, you know, sweeping under the rug from past details. I'm all for it. I like to have a nice cohesive story to look at. Now, you did mention one thing that I wanted to find, and that was that the stories that you read were post-mending. So
yes,
good. Let me talk for a minute about the mending, and when we say pre-mending and post-mending and all of that. So without going into too much detail about the specific storyline, there was a block called Time Spiral where time was getting all kinds of weird and wonky, and some people had time-traveled irresponsibly, left all kinds of big holes in the space-time continuum, or we'll just say big holes in the multiverse, and it was kind of tearing reality apart. Well, these planeswalkers came together. The one thing I failed to mention about planeswalkers is each planeswalker has a spark, which is what allows them to, you know, travel from one plane to another. And specifically, they have a latent spark that has ignited, usually during some kind of big emotional or traumatic event in their life. Bottom line, the spark is this powerful thing that gives them powers to traverse through the multiverse. Well, it used to be that the spark did a whole lot more than just give them a multiverse passport. It basically made them godlike, you know, beings. They could create worlds in some cases. They, you know, could just decimate armies and summon kingdoms and just do basically whatever they wanted. The flavor of it was that because players like us are planeswalkers, okay, well, we're doing all this godlike stuff within the game, so wouldn't it make sense that planeswalkers are like that? So from a flavor point of view, I get it, that makes sense, but it's really hard to write good stories about protagonists who are unkillable, godlike creatures. So fast forward back to the Time Spiral, and you've got the multiverse tearing itself apart, and so all these planeswalkers came together and they sacrificed their sparks to mend the multiverse and sew up, patch up all the holes and make things better again. And it worked and it succeeded and hooray, the multiverse was saved, but it also fundamentally changed the nature of that spark. So no longer did it make planeswalkers these, godlike entities who, you know, could imagine it and it would be done, but they were people. They were mortal. They still had regular lifespans. They didn't, you know, live impossibly long. They could die of old age. They could die of, you know, getting stabbed or beheaded. I'm looking at you, Urza,
ooh,
who was a planeswalker who kept living after he had his head chopped off. But the point is, they were drastically depowered. So when we talk about pre-mending planeswalkers, or, you know, stories that took place pre-mending, we're talking about those godlike planeswalkers. And when we talk about post-mending, which the vast majority of the story that we talk about is going to be, we're talking about those more relatable mortal planeswalkers.
Yes, and definitely, I think one of the interesting parts and fairly consistent parts about these stories that happen immediately, the novels that happen immediately post-mending, is that they all tend to describe planeswalking similarly. So that was something I wanted to touch on. A couple different characters describe it as though you're stepping into like a tempest of matter, like this storm of magical energy that's tearing at your very being, and planeswalkers are the only ones who can make it through that and survive, and sometimes they don't survive. I think that's a very interesting point, especially when we're talking about the Eldrazi. One of the things the Eldrazi do is that they just completely annihilate entire planes. They strip them down, they consume them. One of them, who we'll talk about, Ulamog, turns entire planes into dust, will remove people from existence just by being in their presence. So I think you can definitely see where they get that from their home of the Blind Eternities.
So One thing I'll add on that, and this is Dave's speculation now. This is going outside of canon, but it seems interesting to me that from a psychological point of view, humans really like to have mental shortcuts. We really like to have frame of references, and when our frame of references get thrown out of whack, even if it's just so much as like going to another state or another country, it causes all kind of wacky things to happen with our brain that really throw us off, even aside from like language barriers, just cultural differences. And so for me, I think it's kind of a neat real world comparison or analogy that going from one plane to another is like having an instantaneous frame of reference totally changed up. Like, hey, the rules are totally different here. The species that live here may be totally different. And so I almost see it as like, hey, are you one of those people that can adapt? Are you someone that, you know, can take, even when your frame of reference, even when your normal mindset has been messed with and you have to throw out all of your preconceived notions, are you the kind of person that can switch and be mentally flexible enough to adapt to that and still move forward? Even though it may be a difficult thing to do. So take that as one of my little real-life takeaways from magic. And I'll also say, along with, Adam, your thoughts on the Eldrazi, looking at them as a force that disrupts and removes and warps your current frame of reference, your mindset, those cognitive shortcuts that we all love to cling to, you know, hey, that can be a very destructive or disruptive force in people's lives.
It definitely can. And on that topic, that's exactly what the battle for Zendikar's story is about. So I'll try a brief summary of that. I would definitely recommend checking out the official Magic fiction on it. There's a lot of it, but if you have the time, even just they post them one a week, even if you get through one a week, I would definitely recommend
Adam,
it.
Because still there?
At the end of the day, there is no better source than the people who are creating it. So to start off, we're reintroduced to Zendikar and the Eldrazi. Zendikar is under attack by these ancient beings, the Eldrazi, that have been trapped on the plane. We'll go into more depth on that another time. And they have been released, and now one of them that we know of is decimating the plane. And we have a planeswalker known as Gideon Jura. And he's a mono white planeswalker. And so I think Gideon is best described as a very, almost traditional, knight character, where he stands for truth and justice and honor, and so he's always doing his best to help everyone as he can. That can come back to bite him sometimes.
Yeah, well, and Gideon is really an idealist. Like, when it boils down to it, he has these very strong ideals of what is right and what is wrong, and he is so steadfast and immovable in enforcing those ideals and in following through with them. And, you know, for some people, it makes him a very endearing character. Like, I tend to have a very white, green-centric kind of personality, and so I look at Gideon and I'm like, hey, that is a great hero. From other perspectives, people who maybe more identify as more you know, black or blue, they might see that as kind of rigid and inflexible, you know, too absolute. And, you know, people from more of a red point of view would see that as having a stick up your you know what, and say, hey, that guy's way too uptight. But yeah, I think that that's a great description of Gideon, as someone that is, it's not just that he's passionate, but he's like, hey, when something is right, it must be done, and someone has to do something about it, and Gideon often sees himself as the person who can do something about it.
Yes, definitely. And so Gideon, as we were saying, Gideon is trying to prevent Zendikar from being destroyed. However, he's a planeswalker, he has commitments on different worlds, and so he is, this is actually, I think it definitely demonstrates one of the flaws of Gideon Jura. He's zipping between Zendikar and another world. On Zendikar, he's trying to stop the destruction of the entire world, and on the other plane, he's trying to stop a gang war. So
multitasking doesn't work, people.
It doesn't. And the point of the story actually that these events appear in is that Gideon has not slept in several days, and he keeps going in between worlds. And he's almost losing every battle that he fights here. At one point, he comes back to a world that has been mostly destroyed. He left people behind on Zendikar, and when he comes back, the main city that they've been defending has fallen, that's Seagate. He meets a mermaid named Jori-En, and she claims that the answer to defeating the Eldrazi lies in the puzzle of the ley lines. And so Gideon realizes that this is something he doesn't know anything about. He's going to have real trouble here, and he needs help. Specifically, he needs the help of Jace Bellerin, another planeswalker. So Gideon gets back to Ravnica. That's the other plane he's been interfering on, or providing his help to, I guess. And he tracks down Jace. Jace is a very important political figure, to say the least. And he is on a dinner date with another planeswalker. Gideon interrupts this, and he says, "All right, Jace, you need to come help me defend Zendikar. There's something that needs to be done. I can't do it alone. Jace, I believe, partly to get out of this disastrous dinner date," agrees. He extends the offer to his date, Liliana. She refuses. That's not very surprising. Liliana is mono black. So she's really out after her own gain. I think the telling line that she gives, definitely, and a sympathetic mono-black perspective to take, is some of us have enough trouble to go around without going and borrowing some from other people.
Another telling line that I really loved from that particular story was when, you know, so Jace and Gideon don't know each other. I mean, Gideon knows of Jace before this, but he doesn't actually know Gideon. And, but he's willing to go off and help him, partly because Jace had some responsibility in the Eldrazi being released, which, again, I feel like we, at some point during some future episodes, we may need to devote, like, an entire episode to each planeswalker and how they got to this point.
Definitely.
In the first place. But more to the point, you know, so Jace is willing to go off with Gideon, and Liliana's response is like, "Hey, you know, we have a history, you know, we go back, and you're willing to just go off with this guy, you know, simply because he asked." And Jace's response was, "Well, yeah, but Liliana, you know, one, I have a responsibility, and two, he asked." Like, she had been trying to manipulate, you know, emotionally manipulate him into going with her and you know, saying all these kind of sideways things to try and make it his idea. And he's like, you know, "Look, you could have just asked for help." But that's something that Liliana cannot bring herself to do.
Yes.
And so I loved that particular little dynamic.
That was also, I think, one of my favorite lines from that story. And so Jace and Gideon take off together. They go to a third plane. They're trying to drum up help for this problem because they both know that this is bigger than either of them can face alone. So they go to Chandra Nalar. And Chandra Nalar is a pyromancer. And she lives in a place called Coral Keep. That's a monastery made up of other pyromancers. Monastery isn't typically the word I think of when I think of pyromancers and
fire,
an order. Yeah. But she actually recently has been asked to become the abbot of Coral Keep. She's a planeswalker, so she's very powerful. She's very influential on that world. And so Jace and Gideon arrive as she is about to be, I guess you could say, coronated, whatever the word would be, as she is about to be made abbot. And so they request, "Hey, please come with us. Please come help Zendikar." She has a little bit of history with both of them, more so with Gideon. And because of this and her new position, she refuses. She says that they try to compel her by saying, "Oh, you have a responsibility to help Zendikar." And she says, Well, first of all, responsibility is the wrong word to use with
right.
me.
Right. That is not the way to motivate a red planeswalker.
No. And she also says that even more so, if she was going to follow responsibility, she has a responsibility to her home and to her plane, to the people that she is very close to. Also a very red stance to take. So if we skip around a bit, or in the story it skips around to Nissa Ravain. She is an elf. She's a green planeswalker from Zendikar, so this is her home plane that she is defending herself. She takes a very important role in the story because of this. Because Zendikar is a very wild plane. Zendikar is, I guess, big, and the mana is very boisterous, and it's sometimes chaotic and hard to control. It's a plane that I think embodies a lot of Green's ideals.
It is a very untamed plane, and you know, could be considered untamable. Whereas, you know, like Ravnica has city covering basically the whole plane, and most planes have some kind of, you know, civilization and settlements. Zendikar is like, hey, you might be able to have little towns here and there, some outposts, and but, you know, I think it's telling that, like, the biggest settlement, permanent settlement in Zendikar is just the lighthouse at Seagate, because, hey, the land doesn't like permanent structures being any place, and it's constantly flying around and doing whatever the heck it wants. Mm-hmm. It's a wild place.
It is a wild place. And Nissa, I think, is definitely taking on the role of a much wilder person. Especially in these stories, we see her battling the Eldrazi with an elemental companion that she calls Ashaya. Normally, when Nissa summons elementals, as soon as she's done with a fight, she releases them and they collapse into the earth. They go back to being plants and dirt and whatever makes up an elemental. But Ashaya is a little different. Ashaya has a consistent form the first few times that she's summoned, and after a while she just doesn't go away. She just accompanies Nissa everywhere. And so Ashaya in the Zendikari language that Nissa is using means the awakened world. So cut to Nissa and Ashaya destroying some Eldrazi together. They unfortunately fail to save some members of Zendikari, but they do meet this vampire. This is an interesting story point for me. I think it's really cool to see. I've read Teeth of Akum, so her interaction with this vampire is very interesting. It's a long story, so we'll get to that at a different point. But basically, this vampire gives Nissa some seeds from a continent on Zendikar that has been totally destroyed. It's been wiped out. Nothing there lives. And the vampire says, "All right, please take these seeds. Like, this is all that's left of Belged, of both of our homes. I know you're a planeswalker. Take them somewhere else and plant them so that Zendikar, at least a little bit, can survive." Nissa does take the seeds, but she refuses to plant them on another world because she believes that doing so would mean that she was giving up on Zendikar. That as long as she believes that as long as she acts as though Zendikar will be around forever, she can make it so. At the end of this story, Ashaya teaches Nissa how to see the mystical ley lines of Zendikar. That's that word again, the ley lines, these magical paths of energy that are definitely a very big part of the story upcoming. And so Nissa can tap into these and she can maximize the efficiency and the power of her connection with Zendikar.
Well, and I think it's worth noting, especially because at this point we've introduced all four of the planeswalkers that are in the story. I don't think we're going to be able to get all the way through recapping the entire story through the block up until this point like we were planning on, because there's a lot to go through. But one thing that I do want to say about this, like I said previously, I think at some point we're going to have to use this podcast to go back and talk about with each planeswalker how they got up to this point, because I think that gives some valuable information. Also, I would say definitely do what Adam says and take a chance to get into the story. Formerly known as Uncharted Realms, now it is official Magic fiction, I think. Yes. Or magic storyline or something like that. But actually going in, reading it for yourself, really the creative team at Wizards is on top of their game. I think that their writing is as strong as it's ever been. And one thing that I like about these four Planeswalkers in particular, and I think that this is probably why they were chosen to be four of the five in Magic Origins, the last core set to be released, is because they, you know, there's a lot of Planeswalker characters. You know, there are more than just these ones, but each of them does a really good job of kind of showing a very strong example of the color philosophy that each of them kind of embodies. You know, Gideon and his ideals of white, you know, with right and wrong. Jace with, you know, how he tries to look at every possible situation, plus he's a mind reader, and he tends to be very pragmatic, much less so than people like Gideon.
Yes.
Chandra, who is, you know, all about freedom and wanting to do, you know, what she wants to do, and that, you know, nobody should be compelled to do what others think of them. And Nissa, who's just all about connecting to what is real, you know, what is
tangible.
What is natural, yeah, what is tangible, what is tapping into the way that things should be and embracing that. So, having said that, again, Adam, I do apologize. I think we'll need to save the rest of the recap.
No, definitely.
For another episode.
I think, yeah, that's a good place to stop. We've introduced all our four main characters here, and there's some interesting plot stuff that goes on after this that I would want to devote more time to talk to.
Yeah.
So, on that note, we'll move on to our final section. Coming up right now, we have a game called Vorthos Volleyball. Dave, you're the creator of Vorthos Volleyball on Tumblr. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so this was something that like Adam said, I started doing on Tumblr, and it's just kind of for fun. It's not a game in the sense that anybody can actually win or lose, but it's an activity. It's something that I enjoy doing. And the whole idea of Vorthos Volleyball is taking a question or a and or a card without flavor text, and kind of lobbying it out there, you know, tossing a volley out to everyone else, and seeing what people respond back. So the questions tend to be focused not so much on the mechanics of the game, like, oh, you know, does this card work on that card, or can you destroy this with this other thing? But it's about the flavor. So when we talk about flavor in Magic, it's, hey, when I cast a lightning bolt, you know, yeah, in the game, it does 3 damage. And there's a game mechanics point to all of that, how it gets me closer to winning. But for those of us who love the flavor, Vorthos's is the name that has been given to us. You know, we see it more as, hey, I am shooting a lightning bolt out and electrifying my enemy or one of their creatures or something. So, Vorthos Volleyball is very much about asking questions of cards where it's like, hey, what's the flavor of this? How does this particular thing make sense? Or in the lore, you know, what... I think what it comes down to is asking the question, what should I be imagining here? Like, or what do you imagine when you think about this thing or this thing happens? The other aspect of it is cards that do not have any flavor text, which is the little stuff in italics at the bottom that doesn't have any effect on the rules, except in silver-boarded sets. But is nonetheless, you know, interesting little bits to kind of get your head in the game. So when you post a card without any flavor text, then people can respond back with a volley that includes some suggested flavor text that could be added to that card. I don't think we're going to be going with the flavor text portion That might be a little bit tricky to do. We might try it out. But for now, we thought, hey, why not take this from Tumblr onto the podcast? And so what I did was I picked out some questions from a past edition of Vorthos Volleyball. And I'm going to read those off right now and talk about the answers, and then we're going to be done for the day and finish it up. So the first question comes to us from Blogging Feldegriff. Seeing as planeswalkers can walk between planes with objects, clothes, bidens, etc., what does that limit their travel luggage to? Could they transport living beings, food, plants, boats, etc.? And then YD12K gave the answer, I tend to go with that which they can carry. Short and sweet, as many Vorthos Volleyball answers can be. And then Mirapunk gave the response, given the flavor text on spatial contortion, the transportation of living beings seems out of the question unless they were properly protected. I would hope that they could transport food. Boats and other large objects could probably be transported if they held onto it tight enough. And then for reference, that flavor text Mirapunk refers to is, for those without the planeswalker spark, the merest touch of the blind eternities can kill. Wow. All right, so real quickly, and I do have to end the podcast in just a moment, but Adam, do you want to give your take on that particular question?
Yeah, that's something that I think that's a long time returning question for people. I really like, I guess, just to think about that. And so what I think is that which they can carry is a good general rule of thumb. I think I would also say that it would have to be either inorganic or organic, but non-sapient, non-sentient. So you could carry, like, a very small bird, but you couldn't carry a very small bird through the blind eternities because, you know, it's something that's alive, it's something that's organic, it'll be stripped away into nothing. You could maybe carry a dead bird, something you were planning on eating, especially if you're a Jani. And you could carry, I think, definitely larger things that were not alive. So I think that depends. Like someone says, a boat, other large objects could be transported if they held onto it tight enough. I think in that case, you're looking at larger planeswalkers. Like there are a couple of planeswalkers who are dragons. There are yeah. So there are planeswalkers like, and then there's some who are small children.
Yeah. If you don't make me jump in, because like I said, I do have to hop off.
Definitely.
As many people know, I do have a wife and children, and they are needing my attention. So I would take it back to that thought from earlier about how going from one plane to another is all about a total change up of perspective, and you know those cognitive shortcuts. And I would say anything that has a perspective, anything that has where you know some kind of frame of reference matters. So whether that's you know another sapient being, like another human or an elf or something, or even an animal who just makes sense of the world through you know their sense of smell or anything. Basically, if it is something where a frame of reference matters, that can't make it through. And so I'll go with sticking to my analogy on that one. As far as the size of physical objects, I think you know what you can carry is a good rule of thumb. Just because you know if you try to take something too large, well, again, you know if I try to drive my car through the blind eternities, that's big enough that a frame of reference, even though it's not a living thing, it still matters. There's still, you know, gears and mechanics in there that need to work. And, you know, can I really pull something that big through with me? So I think that's how I would answer that one.
I think that's a great way of answering that. And we have one more, unanswered question from that round.
Yes, so Shorewall, so one of the things about Vorthos Volleyball is it never really ends, it's just when people stop answering questions to Evoli, that's kind of when it peters out. So Shorewall asked a question that never got answered, and that is, are all mages capable of summoning, or are there different specialties? In the card game, creatures are in almost every deck, so is that a general skill? Now, Adam and I aren't going to answer that right now, because we want to put it out to all of you, the listeners. We want to know how you would answer that question, so send it in to us, let us know, and Adam is going to kind of wrap things up with some information on how you can do that, how you can send it in to us.
Yeah, definitely. So, one of the things, as Dave mentioned, he is Flavorical on Tumblr. I run a couple of blogs on Tumblr, but for this specifically, I am going to say that you can email us at mapsandmysteries@gmail.com. So that's and, not the symbol and. And you can contact me on Twitter at onceuponatimewalk or at OUATWalk. All right. And thank you all for listening. Hopefully this will be up a number of places, and if you're listening to this, clearly it is. We've had just a blast talking to you, and hopefully you've had a blast listening. So, signing off.
Thank you very much, Adam, and thank you everybody for joining us. Hey, I really hope we get to do another one.
I do too. Have a good night, everybody.